most exciting 50 years or so of this stuff. Oh, we if you had the papers today, I hopefully would be able to have it back to you if you're in town or if I come by in a week or two. Because that person you said, to relax, where's your papers over there somewhere? To get one and get the other. So I could really try to look. I'd like to use the paper, read the paper. Relaxation in the midst of all the preparations to take us to show. Mind-boggling. Okay, this week we spoke about the Shoah, about the Holocaust, which, Yudom Aharon, this is part of it, really, all I want to say is that the mama. One can only be silent, there's no explanation, no understanding. That's so horrendous. But most of what we can do, and I try to do a little bit of it last week, at least appreciate the horrendousness of that destruction. In terms of commerce, in terms of the quantity of people who are killed, 6 million, in terms of the quality, Dolly Israel, Jesus and Rabbanim and Rebbes and simple bunch of the Yidden who were killed is just overwhelming. It's overwhelming to think about it. And that's why we move into years post World War II for today. Up until very recently, for about 40 years or so, people just didn't think about it. Certainly people who went through the Holocaust there, the reaction was very much, we got to survive, we got to get back, to build a family, build a community, stay alive, find a panosa, find a country that we can live in. And up until maybe 10 years ago, not earlier, very little reflection about the experience by the survivors themselves. You know survivors, you know that typically they don't talk about it. Around 10 years ago, people started talking about it, reflecting about it, and there's a tremendous literature, even in not just in history works and general secular popular works, but even in 50 years, our literature, in art school and the like, and it's been a focus on memoirs and stories about the Holocaust and what it meant and what it went through. But one aspect of a year since the Holocaust is that people were busy rebuilding. It's interesting. The best way, and it's still possible, even for you, at this point in time, the best way to become familiar with what Europe was before the war and what the war meant is by speaking to people who lived through it. And this is only going to be possible for a short time. There's still plenty of people around, by now they're in the 70s, 80s, but there's still plenty from whom you can talk and learn and hear firsthand. Because in no way is reading about it or even seeing videotapes or hearing audio tapes similar to listening to people who've been through it, who can tell you what Europe was like before the war and what the war really meant for them and what coming to America or Eretz Yisrael or whatever meant for them in the years after the war. So one of the people that I listened to a lot about this whole topic was Rav Sterno, Zichron Levracha, who was a Rav here in town in Baltimore, and who was a Talmud of the Minchas Alaza, Munkash Rav. He was not just a Talmud, but he was for the title Rosh Yeshiva in Munkash. Now, in those yeshivas, the Hungarian yeshivas, Munkash in Hungary, Rosh Yeshiva didn't mean what it means in a Lipsish yeshiva. Rosh Yeshiva meant like the, I guess, a Rosh Kollel, like an older younger man, or sometimes even an older bacher who would stay as kind of a shir, who would teach. The shir was given by the Rav, who was the Mukasher Rav, who was what we would call Neda Rav Yeshiva. So Rav Sharma was a very chashuv, a young person in Mogach, and had a great deal to tell about life there, and then hid out through the entire war in a under a floor of a porch of a building in Budapest. And his Svarim, he wrote three volumes of a paper called Kochcha Yitzchak, which in one of the Svarim he writes a Hashama describing in detail his personal experiences throughout the war. And he would speak to it very much. He was different from many people who didn't discuss their wartime experiences. He would discuss them. And he felt it was necessary to discuss them. And he also felt, now he was a Hasidic Yid and a Munkasher. He was quite a Tanoi, extreme Tanoi, in terms of most things that people are Tanoim about. And yet he felt very strongly there should be a day of the year, memorial day to the Shoah. There should be a special Yom Zikaron of some sort. We went in the early 1950s, he went there to Shurov to speak to the Gedolim Ben, the Chazamish, the Bitkarov, and others, Vinerov, and Slavramsky, to speak to them, to try to convince them that there needs to be, the Fruma world needs to have a Yom, what the secular Jews have as a Yom HaShoah, the end of Nisan. He felt this was important, but the opinion of the Gedolim Yisroel was not to have a special day. He argued vehemently, he was a very vociferous, violent kind of person, not violent, but strong kind of person. Now he pushed this, and he suddenly convinced me that it was important. Lately, really, in the past, I don't know, handful of years, there's been an attempt by, within the Torah observant community, to incorporate memory of the Shoah, the whole Shoah experience into Tisha B'Av. And it's really very recent that you have kinos written and pretty widely said nowadays by Rav Schwab and by the Baba Rebbe and by Rav Weissmandl and others, that people more and more say. I mean, it used to be like a big radical move to say an extra kinos. So there's a little bit of a coming back to that. It's interesting that He represented, in my own experience, a person, a big Talmud Chacham, not a Gadol, who had that discipline, the necessity of having a day and a special time for reflection and trying to understand it and make sure everyone remembers it. But I also heard the opposite opinion from the Rebbe of the Rebbe, Sleeper, who is related to my wife's family. We had an opportunity on a family occasion to speak with him, and very informally. And I mentioned this whole question. You know, why does he believe, and he the person who also lived through the Shoah, was a survivor himself. And I asked him, wouldn't it be appropriate to have something more? This is about almost 20 years ago now we had this conversation. Then there was nothing in memory of the Shoah. Shouldn't it be something? Don't bother to even use the word Shoah yet, and I'm just not from circles. So he said, in Yiddish, I'll never forget, that Nish Rangin became Simcha. Right? It won't bring to Simcha. Which I understood in a number of ways. The Hasidic Rebbe, he believes, the whole Tachlis of Avodah Hashem is to do it to Simcha. And what are you going to do? You can have a memorial, you try once a year. Special day, it won't bring to Simcha. It brings to Simcha, building yeshiva. In his case, he rebuilt the whole Hasidus mamash from nothing. He said, that's what we have to do. We have to do things that bring to Simcha. Whatever doesn't bring to Simcha, you don't do. He discussed it more at greater length, but I just remember those few words because it represented the other point of view. What we find in Matthias, of course, is that, as we look back now, beginning to get further enough advance in history that we can look back a little bit, we see exactly what the Gdol Yisrael did, the ones who survived the war. They didn't stop for one split second to be upset, to mourn, to try to figure out what it was all about, but rather they immediately plunged into the job of rebuilding. And the ones who did that were marked with absolutely astounding success. I mean, if you think of it, just without getting melodramatic, just looking at the facts, the whole Olam HaYeshivas in America, everything that you know from any yeshiva whatsoever in America, Koilalim, Yeshivas Katanis, everything, although obviously as you mentioned there were bits and pieces and head starts in small institutions before World War II, but it all came out of the input of a small handful of people who were mostly survivors of World War II, led of course by Rav Aaron Kotler himself, who immediately, I mean mamish immediately, the second that he set foot upon American soil, had several consuming objectives. And I say consuming because I was privileged to see him a number of times, to hear shiurim from him, and he was, you could just look at it, he was a man who was consumed. He was on fire. He was burning. That was his godless. People will confirm that when he said a shiur, he was on fire. But he was on fire on a number of important missions that we can look at from the point of view of history. One was to establish on these, one was Hatzalah. One was to try to save as many Jews that could be possibly be saved, especially the yeshiva brachim from the various yeshivas who were in great danger of being killed by Hitler. And that was one tremendous effort that he spearheaded. That was one thing he was consumed with. The other thing was he was moderately successful. Successful in saving hundreds of Bnei Yeshiva from Europe who then became the nuclei of the future Olam HaYeshiva. This yeshiva, in terms of its history, David Kornblatt was one of the people who were saved by Rav Aaron Kotler's efforts, and he certainly, if you look at the history of this particular yeshiva, a major force. But this is true in all these yeshivas around, that they all have, are what they are because of the hundreds of Talmidim of Mir, Kamenetz, and the other yeshivas that Rav Aaron was able to save through his efforts. Not just his efforts, but he was at the leadership of the Hatzalah movement. That's also a topic which we can't really talk about here, was the tremendously important topic historically, and that's the whole Hatzalah process. More and more is written about that, and I suggest to you the works of David Krangler, K-R-A-N-G-L-E-R, has written a number of works about the Hatzalah movement and what the Frum American Jewry was able to do for Hatzalah. There are a number of books out there now, and some of them are really just being written, but this is a whole growing area. In general, the Jews in America were silent. But there was a noteworthy exception. Rav Aaron, who came here, by the way, in the middle of the war, I think that's 1941, was at the head of that. The other thing he was consumed with was the necessity of building yeshivos and building the quality, intensity of Torah education, recreating what was lost, and establishing a kollel, which was, I mean, from the point of view of logic, was absolute insanity. Start the kollel where people would learn if they're married for years without any degrees or smicha or whatever. This is something that people at first, when they first heard about it, thought he was crazy. Here again I can turn to, literally crazy, and here again I can turn to first person recollection, because I knew very well and had a teacher or mentor, Mr. Irving Bunim, who was a person who needs to be mentioned in American Jewish history. Mr. Bunim, as he was called, was, I knew him because he was the president of the yeshiva that I went to with Roger J. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. But he was a layman, not a drab or anything, a businessman, a wealthy businessman who saw the need, who recognized the godless of Gedolim, and who supported Rav Aaron in all of his works. And Mr. Vunin himself was a very eloquent, articulate speaker, fascinating speaker, who was involved in all of the historical work that Rav Aaron spearheaded. Rav Aaron needed someone who could speak English, someone who was diplomatic and tactful and knew the ropes and had connections, and Mr. Vunin was his man. Rav Aaron's Levaya, if you've ever read about it, Rav Aaron's Levaya, I was also at, there were several Matsidim, included Dr. Rebbe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and others, but Mr. Vunin was the only non-Rosh Yeshiva, non-Rav to speak, and he spoke at Rav Aaron's Levaya. And I knew him well. He gave us classes in Yeshiva on how to conduct yourself, how to raise funds. He had a very practical man. He wrote a book, got several books, but there's one that's really very good. I think it's unknown, not known so widely. It's called Ethics from Sinai. It's three volumes of Pirkei Avos. He was a specialist at teaching Pirkei Avos to general audiences. And he used to for, how many years, I guess, 40, 50, 60 years. He was famous for teaching Pirkei Avos to all sorts of groups. It used to be a hotel in the Catskills called the Pine View before your time, and he would be there all summer, and every Shabbat afternoon, all the guests would sit on the lawn, and he was asking about Pirkei Avos, and this was an experience. I heard him two or three times. But the notes for his lectures on Pirkei Avos are recorded in this three-volume work, Ethics from Sinai. Incidentally, he had one of the world's, a world-class collection of Sfarim on Pirkei Avos. I once saw, I imagine, his son, Amos Vunin, who wrote a book about him called The Soul on Fire. To have that collection now, but it must have been easily 1,000 works on Pirkei Avos. Easily 1,000, not more. But he was an extremely important person in American Jewish history, especially World War II Jewish history, for a number of reasons. First of all, he was one of the founders of the Young Israel Movement. If you read Amos Vunin, his son's book, For a Soul on Fire, you learn that up until World War II, there was a great danger, a tremendous great danger, that Jews who thought of themselves as being frum would become what are now called conservative Jews. That at one point in time, it was very appealing to a Jew who really was on the Shabbos and everything to drive to shul, to do various things that, in the perspective of those times, he didn't realize the seriousness of. And it was through the efforts of Mr. Vunin that, greatly through Mr. Vunin and several selected Rabbanim at that time, that this trend was stopped. And one of the ways that it was stopped was through the development of the Young Israel Shul, which were shuls peopled by Americans who had very little yeshiva background, but who maintained Shmirat Shabbos and Shmirat HaMitzvahs 100%. This is an extremely important crossroads in American Jewish history. Mr. Vunin was able, to his credit, to see that that approach was something for its time, and that with the arrival of post-World War II of the various Gedolias Dror who survived, it was time to go beyond that and to move into building yeshivas, etc. And the whole, what today is the tension between centrist Judaism, modern Orthodoxy, call it what you wish, on the one hand, and the Olam HaYeshivos on the other hand, some of that tension begins back at a time when Young Israel was considered the right of the right, and then when the Olam HaYeshivos came and began to grow, and that became the center. Historically, the whole dynamic goes back